Hello, and welcome to another episode of Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mappa. I'm an actor and comedian. I've never done ketamine.
That is excellent news. My name is Matthew Dempsey. I'm a psychotherapist and multicultural counselor. And we're going to talk about drugs.
There's a point. We're talking to our friend Quinn Cummings today, yes. Oscar nominated actress, writer, humorist, because she is she did ketamine assisted psychotherapy.
Yes, that's
K-A-P.
Right.
K-A-P. Yes. So yes. What's that? I'm asking you with two master's degrees from Columbia.
Yes. Well, okay. First of all, let me just kind of put this out there that this is not my specialty. This is not the specific thing that I've studied, but I have just a little bit of insight into it.
Yeah, you read about it on Facebook.
I've read it. So I'm an expert. So ketamine is it's a psychedelic drug. It's used, a lot of people think of it as like, you know, horse tranquilizer party
yes.
drug. But it's been used medically for years, and it's been used to, you know, kind of remove pain or kind of reduce pain in treatments for animals, but also humans. And when it's done in extreme amounts, that's when you can kind of get to a place where you're like tripping and having these kind of psychedelic experiences and having visuals. And some people, if they do too much, fall into K-holes, which means it's kind of this like dark hole. So there's been this newer treatment that's become available where if ketamine is administered by a medical professional and also then can be accompanied by a psychotherapist who helps kind of help you navigate whatever kind of experience you're having.
Right.
Then it can be something very helpful, because what it does is it helps us to not just physically kind of block pain receptors so that, you know, we can, you know, kind of do what we need to do physically with surgeries and things like that. But it also then can help remove some of the discomfort and the emotional pain that might be there that keeps us blocked from being, it could be a very kind of defensive response to some emotional discomfort and pain that we might have. So it helps remove some of those defenses so we can maybe access some more of the feelings that we have and some of the kind of deeper thoughts and belief systems that we have. So then we can kind of process it in some new ways. We don't have to be blocked off to it, but we can kind of process it. So this therapy basically kind of helps us do that. It reintroduces us to some of our deeper thoughts and feelings in a way that then we can manage them and keep them open so we can connect to other people.
Right. It makes you less inhibited so that you can process those things that you normally wouldn't if you
yes.
weren't altered.
Yes.
I love that everything starts off as like a clinical drug, like
yeah.
it starts, and then somebody, some asshole goes, "Hey, I want to take that at a party." And then it becomes like, because the only thing I've heard about K is like gay guys taking it at a dance or something and,
yes.
and ending up in a K hole where somebody's going, "You're not dying. I'm right here. I'm holding your hand. You're going to be okay." But you forget
yes.
that it starts out as a drug that treats people yes. psychologically for PTSD or people
right,
who
or
are having a difficult emotional time. I heard about a trial that's happening at UCLA right now where they give their microdosing LSD to people who are experiencing pain and fear due to terminal illness.
Yeah. Yes.
That I'm dying, I'm scared, I'm afraid. And they come out of the therapy
yeah.
less fearful and
totally.
More at peace with what's happening. So it sounds like K therapy.
Mm-hmm. is what we'll call it on the slide.
Yeah. K assisted therapy. Helps people in that way. Would you
yeah,
agree?
There's really a few different kinds of treatments that exist out there. You know, I mean, you're talking about like LSD, but ketamine, mm-hmm. there's also ayahuasca that some people might know about.
Right.
And so there are these drugs, or people would just call it medicine, that really kind of like help open and expand some of our neurological processes, the ways that
right.
we think, because we can access different parts of our brains. And we can, you know, kind of go into these places that we otherwise might be really afraid to go there, right? Like we've kind of walled off, and especially, so these kinds of treatments can also be particularly effective for people who have PTSD and
right.
have suffered some real kind of trauma, because
right.
it helps us access some of the processes that go into the, you know, kind of the traumatic events and what's kept us walled off in those ways. And it helps us navigate that so we can kind of open some of that up without it feeling like it's taking us down, that it's too
right.
overwhelming. Yeah.
And on the other side of that, the benefit of that is you come out of it like, hey, I'm not as scared. I'm not as worried. I'm not as anxious.
Sure. Yeah. Well, because
ultimately,
I'm all about the end game. I mean, listen, but the things that you're talking about, even, you know, people who are facing their own mortality or who just have this immense fear of death, people who've gone through traumatic events, things like that. I mean, it's just like this, you know, it's an immense and debilitating fear. And so we have a defense to that. So we can kind of dissociate from that feeling. You know, we kind of wall off, we disconnect from the emotional experience of it. So we don't have to feel that pain and the suffering. But then there are all these other kinds of, you know, disadvantages and limitations that comes from that way of living too, because then, you know,
I think it seeps out somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like a water balloon with a hole.
Where's it seeping out?
It's going to seep out. I'm just saying, because like my trauma was, you know, we grew up very affluent, my family.
Yeah.
And when I was 13, 14 years old, we were wiped out financially and our family was never the same ever.
Yeah.
Ever the same. It really kind of wrecked us. And all the relationships changed, our geography changed. And so how that manifested in my adult life is whenever money came up, money issues, I'd have anxiety attached regardless of to the amount of money I had. But I went to EMDR. They walked me through the experiences again of what happened. And I was able to look at it in a safe way.
Yes.
And coming out of it, I'm concerned about money, certainly, but I'm not like up at nights going, I'm going to be homeless. We're going to end up destitute. Where I don't awfulize the way that I used to.
EMDR is an interesting one because, I mean, that's obviously not a medically assisted therapeutic process.
I always forget what it stands for.
It's eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And so what that means
is what he said.
It's basically like, you know, if you've ever taken like a psych 101 course or whatever, it's kind of like there's like REM sleep, like there's the different stages of sleep, and then there's REM sleep, right?
Yes.
Which means rapid eye movement, because at night when we're sleeping, you can, if you ever even notice, you can kind of notice that like eyes dart back and forth, left and right. It's creepy. Yeah. Because that's the way that our brain is downloading information from the day and processing that information.
When your eyeballs are moving back and forth, it's your brain is like, you're also like, is that your eyes moving through the dream? Kind of like, oh,
sure. You know, if we want to kind of go with the hypothesis that dreams is just a representation of our thoughts and emotions that help us kind of, you know, process information for the day. Sure. But all this anyway, kind of helps us process information. And so EMDR, you know, there's a variety of ways that you can do that. You know, you might have a kind of like a little kind of like a pulsating thing on each hand.
I did that.
So that it'll pulse back and forth, left, right, left, right. Mm-hmm. Or you can even just kind of tap on your leg, left, right, or whatever. There's a few different ways, but it helps kind of process back and forth, left, right, as you're talking about the traumatic event, because now it's helping bring it into the frame of consciousness for you. You're talking about it, you're processing it, and you're desensitizing and reprocessing this information for you, but you're doing it with the assistance of a psychotherapist who helps you now navigate it in more effective ways so that you can do it in healthier ways and you can frame things a little bit differently. And you're also less over-identifying with the experience itself.
You know what happened to me after my very first session?
What?
I felt so horny. Like hornier than usual. I was like, I have to have sex.
Yes, it's opening your chakras.
Is that what it is? I was like, I want to shove a chair up there right now. Like something has to happen. Like all the furniture was missing from my house. Listen, I'm all for any kind of therapy that helps us access our deeper emotions and live a healthier, happier life. We have a great guest on the program today. She's my friend, Quinn Cummings, and she's going to talk about the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. See, I get it right.
Very good.
Eventually, I get it right. And we'll talk to her after these important messages.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
We have a very special guest today. She was a child actor who starred as Lucy McFadden in Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
Since that time, she's written three books, including Notes from the Underwire and Year of Learning Dangerously. You can also find her on Twitter under the hashtag QuinnC, QUINNCY, where she writes a small story every day about her life. She's so smart, so funny. She makes the best cocktails back when I was drinking. We have a tale to tell her too. Please welcome to the show, author, humorist, and dear friend of mine, Quinn Cummings. Yay!
Yay!
Applause, applause. Welcome.
I could not be more excited. Do I listen to your podcast? Are you already a friend in my mind, Matthew? You are. You are.
I've been wanting you two to meet. I think that you two would be like every time I introduce Quinn to one of my friends, they become her friends on a deep cellular level.
Oh, wow.
I'm like a slime. I just collect. I just keep moving forward. Yeah, you're mine now.
Good. I feel warm and safe.
And you're mine.
So ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Quinn, you started off, from what I understand, this was on assignment. You were Lois Lane.
Yes.
This was a journalistic thing. So walk us through that.
Sort of Lois Lane, sort of Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay,
because
got it.
Because Lois Lane wouldn't have heard about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and thought, wait a moment, I could trip and get paid? Yeah, Lois wouldn't have done that.
No.
I knew of a psychiatrist. Now, just for those people who never remember the difference between psychiatrists and psychologists, it doesn't make a huge bit of difference for the most part, except for a few things. Psychiatrist means you go to med school. Why this affects the story is that ketamine is it is used in medical protocols. It is a medicine. If you go to med school, you can write script for medication. If you don't go to med school, it's harder to do that.
Right.
So this psychiatrist was writing script for ketamine for a therapist, and then the therapist would stay with you through the trip. And this was being used by fancy pants Hollywood people, like people who write summer tentpole movies, who were blocked writing the second act of a 5-year huge multi-million-dollar contract for a bunch of summer tentpole movies. And yes, this cost a lot, but what is $5,000 or $6,000 if you're getting paid several million dollars to write these movies?
Right. So every series regular is doing this right now in order to kind of get through the season.
If you are paying $5,000 to your ex-wife's dietitian for last month's being told to drink more water, what is $5,000?
Right, right.
And the anecdotal report coming back was that it was moving people out of creative blocks they had been in for months.
Okay.
That, all right, so going back to what Matthew was talking about before, the thing about ketamine is it is a dissociative drug. What does that mean? Why does it work for PTSD? Why does it work for writer's block? Because it moves you out of the reactive phase of a trauma into a place where you're a little bit away from it. And you can look at it and think, that is a feeling, but that is not a feeling I'm always going to be in.
Right.
Or if you're blocked creatively, the sense you have is, and I'm always going to feel this way. Mm-hmm. I am never going to figure out what to do with this character.
Right.
Oh God, I can't breathe.
Right.
And ketamine allows you, on a non-scientific level, and then I'll jump to what the science of it is.
Okay.
It allows you to look at the feeling for a second and say, that is a feeling. I don't like that feeling, but it is just a feeling, which is why it works for PTSD. People with PTSD can go through therapy for years and have a certain amount of work done with it. But ultimately, if your trauma is left over, we're talking about veterans today.
Yeah.
If your trauma is based on, I was on a wide highway and then it blew up in front of me, mm-hmm. and now I'm on a wide highway. Oh God, there's only so much you can do psychologically to talk yourself out of it ahead of time. Frequently, you're in the trauma
correct.
Before you can even start to untalk.
The minute you're triggered, you go into lizard brain.
You're already
reliving it. The closest thing I've had to this kind of therapy is when I did EMDR, where they were
exactly.
like eye movement. And the quickest explanation I can have for the benefit of that is they'll walk you through a traumatic experience and it becomes more of a movie you saw as opposed to a lived experience. So,
exactly.
so and when you think about those experiences, like, boy, that was a really scary movie, as opposed to that really happened to me.
And the other word for that would be disassociative.
That is
a thing I'm seeing as opposed to a thing I am reliving.
All right.
So the science behind ketamine is that if you do a scan of a brain of somebody who is depressed, if you ask them about their lives, eventually they're going to come to some variation of, my life feels smaller and darker. Mm. Here's the weird part. If you look at their brain, their brains actually look smaller and darker. All right. So axons, dendrites. Dendrites are the little sort of the wiggly things where the chemicals go across to the other dendrites, down to the axon. And this is how the chemicals pass through your brain.
Have you seen that film of the dendrite walking across the actual
yes.
chemical? It's so
yes.
cute. It looks like Gumby. It's just,
okay.
yeah.
So you, Alec, you and I are talking to one another and the science people are just waiting out the pain. I understand.
Matthew, did you have to study this stuff in your,
yes.
at Columbia? You
yes.
did. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So he's screaming inside.
It's
no,
bringing back
you're
that trauma.
You're speaking very well about it clinically.
Thank you. All right. So when you are depressed, when you are anxious, when you are traumatized, the dendrites actually pull back slightly.
Mm.
So part of what the chemical process of an antidepressant is to help the chemicals. It has to basically put a little bit of an oomph, Miracle-Gro behind the chemicals
right.
to get them across what is now a longer divide. For reasons we still do not completely understand, ketamine and some of the other drugs in that category rebuild the dendrites.
Oh, permanently?
Yeah.
Oh.
And sometimes the trauma can start to erode it again. Sometimes people need to have it redone. For some people, it doesn't work at all. It seems to be about a 33-33-33 results so far. And again, mm-hmm. the numbers are still small, but about 33% of people see no result. 33% seem to be worse for some reason, and 33% seem to be better. And what's interesting is the worse you are coming in, the more traumatized, the lower you are coming in, the higher the result. The anecdotes of people coming out of a single session saying, oh my God, I'm alive.
Right.
Those people are not the ones where they're like, a little creatively blocked.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not going to tell someone else's story, but I don't pretend this is a world changer. I tell the data that I have to people.
Yeah.
And I know of someone who heard my story who was in a very bad way.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very bad way. And she walked out after the first session saying, for the first time in my adult life, I don't want to die.
Yeah.
I heard that the LSD treatments, where they're microdosing people with LSD at UCLA, that mm-hmm. study, they were doing it for people because it speaks to what you were saying about the worst the case.
Mm-hmm.
They were giving it to administering the treatment to people with life-threatening illnesses.
Sure. Yeah.
And they came out of it less fearful,
mm-hmm.
more at peace with what was happening and less kind of panicked about it.
Sure.
So my clinical question to Matthew is how would you as a professional, would you ever kind of like, how would you know when somebody's blocked in their treatment of depression? Like, we have to go a little deeper. We got to bring out the bigger guns here.
I mean, it really depends, you know, if you just kind of use traditional talk therapy and just see how well that might work and be able to help open things up or process. If there's some kind of, you know, if some of those approaches are proving to be effective, then we'll keep on that. But if it seems as though that, you know, clients are still just kind of mired down, they're feeling stuck and unable to, you know, find their way out of some of it, then, you know, some of these kind of like these newer or even less traditional approaches can be just a great option. And it's just enough to offer the information to see if it's even something that somebody might connect with or resonate with to want to explore that additional thing. So that's how, that's kind of the approach I would take. Yeah. But the interesting thing and the thing that I kind of want to say, Quinn, speaking to kind of what you were talking about of like the efficacy, you know, kind of how well it works and for whom it works. I do not myself administer any of these kinds of treatments, like the ketamine psychotherapy or like ayahuasca or any of these additional kind of like, you know, psychedelic approaches to therapy. But I have worked with clients who've done kind of a variety of these things. And kind of the thing that I have noticed just myself, my own kind of observations on things is that it is incredible. So a lot of these different treatments are really incredible about kind of like chemically kind of activating some things like you were talking about to be able to help, you know, get some new kind of messaging going on for us to be able to have new insights and new awarenesses to open things up. But what also needs to happen that a lot of times doesn't, which is kind of why I like the kind of psychotherapeutic component attached to the ketamine, is that you can have these awarenesses, you can, you know, have that insight and that's great. Unless it's attached to some other kind of behavioral follow-up where you're now kind of reintroducing some new patterns of behavior in your life, then those, like, you know, we're talking about like dendrites and, you know, things that can happen kind of neurologically for us kind of like wither back into how they were before. So having the behavioral component kind of in, you know, outside of that treatment to be the thing that helps reinforce these new insights is what also really helps kind of make some of these things a little bit more impactful and effective in a longer term sense. Not just having kind of like a quick realization that lasts for like maybe a week or two and you feel good, but something that can be a little bit more effective long term.
Absolutely. I think that reintegration is a huge part of this because, as you know, insurance companies are increasingly unhelpful when it comes to mental health, shall we say.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
They were never great and they're getting worse.
Yes.
And my concern has always been that their attitude is going to be, okay, we'll pay for ketamine. You're done now. You're good, right?
Yeah.
And, I think it the way it's frequently described is it's 6 months worth of therapy in 3 hours.
Yeah.
But it's no one who's doing it is saying it's a lifetime's worth of mental health work in 3 hours.
Yeah.
It moves you forward drastically. And then there can be a conversation
to the next place.
It's an addition. It's an addition to talk therapy. It's not meant to.
I think so.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to drop you off. I'm going to pick you up and then I'm going to drop you off 6 months down the road and your voyage will continue. Would you be comfortable? Listen to me talk Matthew here. Would you be comfortable sharing with us your experience?
Absolutely.
Of it? Okay.
No, not a word.
Not at all. And we're done. That's my hot message of the day. I'm not talking about nothing.
Okay, so for the first one, I was absolutely doing it for the article. You know, there aren't that many times in your life someone else pays for your trip.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was never going to do it socially. I don't trust people. And for me to say to even someone I consider to be a good friend, you know, oh yeah, that bit of paper, I'll put it in my mouth. Cause I'm like, sure, I trust you, but who'd you get it from? Do I know them? No, no, we're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
There's a certain leap you have to take whenever there's drugs involved.
Yeah.
You can't question it.
I won't wear a tube top in public. I don't trust others.
Yeah. So when you go to the doctor, you get the good stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Exactly. I want oversight.
Okay.
But I did it for the article, but I also wanted to see what it would break loose in me a little bit.
Okay.
When I was a child, when I was 9 years old, my father died very suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being on a couch, lying on a couch a few months after he died and feeling as if I was going to I felt as if I was falling, and I was reasonably certain I was going to be falling for the rest of my life.
The physical sensation, you had a physical sensation of falling?
It was an emotional sensation so profound it became a physical sensation.
Okay. All right, got it.
And it was just that moment in Alice in Wonderland where she just keeps falling and falling and falling mm-hmm. and falling. I think it's mm-hmm. Alice through the looking glass. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, and I was at most 10 years old, I remember thinking, I feel terrible and I am going to feel terrible for the rest of my life because my father's going to be dead for the rest of my life. There's no reason to think this feeling will ever stop.
Yeah.
So I remember the triage decision I made at that moment, which is I will feel nothing because nothing is better than this.
Yeah, dissociate.
I will cut off all the bad feelings and we'll see where that gets me. And I remember an almost physical sensation of a tourniquet applied to my emotions and then feeling better.
That's so interesting. There are so many people who describe kind of what you're talking about, kind of like this dissociation, who can specifically remember the moment when they made that decision and how things flipped and then what their experiences, had been moving forward.
Ginger Minj talked about that. It's like, we've had so many emotionally precocious people on the show who at a young age made those decisions in their head about which road am I going to take?
Sure.
So you make the decision to cut off all of those bad feelings. And then how did that manifest in your adult life? Did you have a conscious idea of it carrying over or did you just forget about it?
What it does, it's like, you got to read the contract. You always got to read the contract all the way to the end. In the bottom of that contract that I signed, where I decided I would have no more bad feelings, it said in very faint typeface, but you're going to lose a bunch of the good feelings too.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. You can't self-select.
And what I had done was I had taken out the absolute bottom range, but I had also cut myself off from the absolute top.
You know, they talked about, you'll love this. Brené Brown talks about that joy is like one of the most vulnerable feelings you can feel.
Yeah.
And that can be scary to be happy. And I was like, really? And then she talked about the thing of like seeing your child asleep.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're filled with all this positive chemicals. I love you. And then the next thing is like, oh no, what if they get hurt? I have to think about the next 20 years of their lives. And I was like, oh, that's how it feels. So you're saying you were cut off from the good stuff as well.
Oh, absolutely. And so I went into this knowing that a lot of the time in my life, and it wasn't terrible. I'm capable of love. I've been with the same guy for 27 years. Mm-hmm. There've just been a lot of moments in my life where I looked around at everyone else and thought, I think they're getting more than I am.
Yeah.
I think they're feeling more than I am.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yep.
Just a sense of like, no, I know how much I'm feeling. And they're, that looks a lot louder than what I'm feeling.
Oh. Yeah, totally. Yes. I've never been through that experience where I have, you know, kind of fully kind of dissociated in that way. But I think as probably a lot of people can relate to, you have moments where you just kind of pull back a little bit, right? Like you just kind of a little bit more to yourself or closed off, you know, and then you could be with your friends or you could be at a party or whatever. And you can feel that kind of what you're talking about, a version of that, right? Where you just kind of feel like I'm not connecting with these people who I normally would connect with. Like I'm not really connecting in some way. And it's like when we wall ourselves off from our own feelings as a way of protecting ourselves, it also keeps us walled off from connecting to the humanity of every other person, right? Like our emotionality, that's how we can connect with other people. We don't have everybody's unique experiences in life, but we do have, you know, a lot of shared emotional experiences. So the dissociation keeps us detached.
My version of this is whenever I do a play, back when I did plays and I knew we were closing, I say goodbye to everybody 2 weeks in advance. So 2 weeks, I will go to everybody's dressing room and give them a present and say, I love you. I've had such a great time with you. And people are like, what the fuck, Alec? We don't close for another two
weeks.
We're
not done yet.
We have 14 performances left. But what happens is on closing night, people are hugging and crying. And meanwhile, my dressing room is cleared. My shit is all gone. I'm just, and everybody's hugging and crying, and I'm in the corner going, smoking a cigarette going, bye. Like I've already moved on. And I've done that always to kind of like, and some people have said to me, isn't there some benefit in like feeling what everybody else is feeling?
Yeah.
And like, and I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling everything, what everybody else is feeling, but 2 weeks in advance. So when Quinn, when you said.
How like, very controlled, Alec. How know, very when, controlled.
When you said, everybody's feeling more than me. That's my version of it.
Yeah.
I'm closing nights when everybody's like, boo-hoo-hoo, and I'm like that. So did you come in with that agenda for this paid session of like, I'm going to try to like figure that out?
I am. Yes. And it was a little bit of, okay, let's see what's behind the door.
All right.
The way, another way that I describe ketamine is at the beginning of COVID, what is time? We were all watching Marie Kondo.
And, yes.
Yeah. And she would have everybody put their clothing on a bed. You had to grab everything out of the closet and just throw everything on the bed. And then you had to consider each object.
Does it spark joy?
Does it spark joy? What is your emotional reaction? The way I would describe ketamine is all the doors in your head get unlocked. Everything gets dumped in the middle and you have to decide. No, you get to decide what matters. And that's what I wanted, was to start having a relationship with, okay, do I want to have feelings? Do I want to have big feelings? Maybe I don't have big feelings everywhere. My family's kind of cold. You know, I always joke, but don't, that my mother and I could have a screaming fight in a restaurant and no one knew.
Right.
And we could even stop when the wait staff came by.
Yeah.
Right. We could tell them the meal was lovely. And then we could get back to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're kind of cold.
That's it.
Maybe I didn't have a lot of big feelings.
So walk us through I'm sorry. I keep interrupting.
No. Go.
Walk us through the practical, what happens in the session? How long is it? You're administered the K. Is it a nasal spray?
The psychiatrist would come in, and this is for physician assisted. The second time I did it was in a ketamine clinic. They put you in a room. They put an IV in your arm. Okay. But with the therapist in the room, the psychiatrist, the medical doctor walks in, hands you a bit of paper. You stick it in your cheek, between your cheek and your jaw. It tastes foul. Whoever is creating ketamine paperwork, you could add a little cinnamon. It's all
A little mint, something. Please.
Yes, a little butterscotch.
Right. And I said to the therapist, okay, how long before it takes effect? She said 11
Count
minutes.
Down from 10.
Well, she said 11 minutes. I said, that's awfully specific. And then we were just chatting. And then all of a sudden, I wanted to shut my eyes. And she said, where are you? I said, I'm on the back of a beetle.
Hello.
A large, shiny black bug.
With your eyes closed,
I wanted to close my eyes.
Okay. So you're kind of like dreaming with your eyes closed, but you're still cognizant of people in the room. So right now in the room is you and the therapist, and you're in a chair. Are you lying down? Are you sitting comfortably?
I was in a chair, not unlike this.
Okay.
She and I had a therapy session ahead of time to talk about, okay, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, understood. Okay. That's like EMDR.
Just like, all right, so tell me what your family was like.
Yeah.
It was an interesting session for me because I haven't done hallucinogens before. Turns out, like with everything else in life, I'm kind of an observer by nature.
Yeah.
And she kept wanting to talk to me. And it turned out I just kind of wanted to be quiet.
You're like, hold on, I'm watching the movie. Stop talking to me.
Yeah. Please stop talking during the film. I'm concentrating. Yeah. I don't know where Guy Pearce is right now. He's in a motel and he's writing things on notes. If I don't pay attention, I'm going to not
He's on the
anything.
Beetle behind me.
Yeah.
I am carrying him with me. I have red vines and it's a movie. But it was interesting in the session. 3 hours later, we talked about a bunch of stuff. 3 hours later, I opened my eyes again. I felt fine. You feel, I was given a ginger tablet ahead of time. Some people get nauseated.
Oh.
My daughter drove me home. We got Mexican food on the way home. She kept looking at me saying, I just need you to know I'm not taking you to Burning Man now. This is not the beginning of the phase of your life. It's like, or maybe it is.
So but it really is an assisted talk. You're in the space and they talk to you for 3 hours about, okay, you're on the back of the Beetle and let's go from there.
Mm. Let's go from there. I will tell you the moment for me, because again, I didn't come in a crisis. So I didn't have the great jump upwards. I enjoyed it.
Right.
I will tell you when I knew there were new dendrites and new patterns of behavior. About 2 weeks later, we were replacing our refrigerator. Gee, I don't know why I called it my couch.
Do you nap in your refrigerator?
That refrigerator makes me feel so comfy. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And we had had it for 20 years. And so there was a bunch of stuff under the, and the guy bringing in the new refrigerator was taking the old one. So out he removes the old one. And I have like 6 minutes to clean under there, which is going to have to hold us for another 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm scrubbing. And I look up and there is my sweetheart, who I refer to publicly as consort. Mm-hmm. I adore this man and he is better than I deserve, 100%. The one thing he does that will drive me to eventually kill him is he cleans after me. And this makes me insane. Because it's like, what? Did I?
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't do this correctly. Yeah. You didn't do this correctly. Yeah.
Okay. So I look up and there he is standing with his favorite mop. And he has a favorite mop.
That is an important part of this part. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That tells you everything about this man. And he's standing there looking at me like, please don't shout at me. I just want to clean after you. And I was prepared to begin the fight, the pointless shout that we have about, why do you not just accept that I've done a good enough job? Mm-hmm. And we were going to get into our whole usual, we've had 20 years of this particular discussion. Yeah.
Of you taking and this behavior personally.
Yeah. And I went to open my mouth and I realized, I don't care. It's like, okay, if that's a thing that matters to you, okay.
You were less reactive.
The reactivity was no longer there. I was prepared to jump on a bus which hadn't arrived. And it was that moment where I thought, oh, this is why it works for PTSD.
I could use that.
Because the response wasn't there for me. I was expecting the reaction wasn't there.
Okay. What you were saying earlier too, is that what it really can do, what it really helps facilitate, is that you can be more aware of some of the things that are going on for you and also give yourself a little bit of distance. So you're not over-identifying with it, but you can observe it. And then there, instead of just over-identifying and reacting from it, you can observe and give yourself a beat so that you then can respond. And it sounds like in a moment like that, you can see like, oh, this is the thing that annoys me because I do take it personally. Exactly. I know it's not personally, it's an act of love. So I don't need to then clap back. I'm just going to let it, you know, mop with the favorite mop.
That's what I love about therapy, is that when you could see the results in your own life, when I was no longer reactive to my father, when I'm not taking him personally, you know, the crazy things that he does. For me, when I did EMDR, the trauma that they walked me through was when I was 14 years old, our parents were wiped out financially. Mm. And what that did for me as an adult is if I had money, I had a sense of dread. If I didn't have money, I had a sense of dread. And it would just be this sense of dread around finances all the time that followed me my entire life, regardless of the amount of money I had. Right. And when I walked through EMDR and they walked me through those experiences and I got the distance, the disassociative feeling about it. When money comes up now in discussions, I no longer feel that that dread, that feeling of something horrible is going to happen. That's going to be, the world is going to end. Yeah. So you're saying, Quinn, it made you less reactive in that moment. And that was enough for you to go back again and do it on your own dime?
Yeah. No, I waited a couple of years just because I have a child at a small liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. You know, money is going out the door at a great rate of speed. But this past summer, and bless him, consort has nerves of steel, because he actually said to me, have you considered doing that again? Which is something you don't say to anybody.
Yeah. Me, my mop and I were wondering something.
Yeah.
How'd you like more shock treatment? How about some more Edison medicine to take the edge off of things?
and I looked at him and said, that's a lot of nerve, dude. Mm-hmm. And what he said in effect was, things are getting easier now, and you're still, you seem like you could be having more fun. And I thought about shouting, and then I went, oh, but he's not wrong. Mm-hmm. And here's where I came back to the idea of the emotional responses when I was a kid. I thought, all right, I want to connect with real joy, real complicated feelings. Yeah. And I think part of my concern now has been, but I suspect if the emotions are a pipeline, there's a lot of ew that's going to have to get cleared out before I get to all of the, and so part of me is like, it's fine where I am. I'm fine.
Yeah. And I have the right amount of feelings.
I have an portion acceptable is good. Amount. I have an acceptable amount of feelings. Thanks. And I thought, what if I don't? And I thought, okay. And what's funny is that ketamine as a dissociative drug should be the absolute opposite of what would work for that, because in some ways it's creating distance. My thinking was, all right, what if I give myself permission in a purely mechanistic way to say, I know that if any of the sadness or the anger or the frustration comes up, I give myself permission to know those feelings pass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's the mop feeling again, like, okay, that's just a thought.
Impermanence.
Yeah. And so that's what, you know, talking about the idea you were talking before about, you have to go into ketamine with set and setting. And I didn't have a therapist guiding me this time, but each time the needle went into my arm and I put on the blindfold, what I would say to myself is, lovely journey.
Setting the intention.
That speaks
experience.
To what you were saying earlier, Matthew, about the subjective feeling about where you are.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm getting the wrap up sign from my producer because I want to talk about this. I'm fascinated by this. It's interesting because you were a child actress, and Goodbye Girl was one of my favorite movies as a kid. And I've watched the performance recently, and you are playing a girl who is very stoic throughout, who's kind of like, you're a 40-year-old trapped in the body of a 10-year-old. And that was your stock and trade. But your big emotional scene in that movie is where Richard Dreyfuss keeps needling you to get to a vulnerable place. And you do kind of break down. And it's kind of like, that kind of like is, it kind of encapsulates what you were talking about of like somebody, the ketamine taking you back to from a place where you're holding it all together.
Yeah.
Right. Where just accessing that part of you.
Yeah. And I am not using it this time in any of the protocols that are being studied right now. There's a lot of really interesting data with PTSD, with treatment resistant depression, with treatment resistant anxiety. What I'm going for is more blurry. But I will say this, I'm getting some interesting results. Like a couple mornings ago, I woke up and I said to the guy, I'm just mad this morning. So I'm going to go out and go be mad elsewhere because I'm not mad at you. I'm just mad.
Yeah.
I think mad's got to clean through the pipeline.
Yeah.
But again, it's ride the wave. Feeling of, and it's just kind of like, okay, I'm going to go be mad and hike as opposed to this feeling alarms me, or I need to figure out why I'm mad. Maybe mad just exists and then it leaves.
Yeah.
It sounds like you have less of a value judgment on the emotions coming through. Like you're the sentry at the post going, okay, you're fine. Instead, as opposed to like, nope, sorry, that's as far as you're going.
Yeah, exactly. And that is precisely, you clever boots.
Gosh, this is so great, Matthew. We have to wrap up. This is like so fascinating to me. We're going to have to talk about this more at length when we see each other socially. We didn't even talk about your burgeoning Twitter career, where if you're not following Quinn on Twitter, you absolutely have to. So what would be your hot message to somebody similar to you who is watching other people? Because we always wrap up with a hot message. Who's watching other people have more feelings than they are?
I can't. The great hot message of the world is, do not worry about what other people are thinking of you. Mm. They're not.
Mm. They're not. They really aren't.
The hot like message is nobody cares.
Nobody's concerned as you are, is what you're saying. Yes. I mean, the way that we kind of eat our hearts out about, like, you know, reputation and perception and everything. Nobody else is thinking about those things.
The hypercriticism.
Where can people find you on your socials, Quinn Cummings?
Oh, I adore true crime. And I have this joke that if I'm ever brought in by a police officer and they say, where were you? And I'll say, I was on Twitter. And they'll say, we haven't even told you the time. It's like, doesn't matter. I was on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter.
Fantastic. All right, Quinn, thank you so much for being so candid and sharing with us this fascinating journey. I'll see you soon.
Love you, kitten.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Matthew, this has made me question how many feelings I have. Like, because I laugh every day.
Yeah.
I yell at my husband a little too much. I always regret it. But I feel anger. I feel sadness.
Yeah.
I feel I don't know if I want extra feelings.
Sounds like you're experiencing the broad spectrum of the human experience.
Do you feel like you have the appropriate amount of feelings, or that you're kind of?
Yes, I think that whatever we feel is the exact right amount of feelings we're supposed to feel. I think that if we maybe kind of feel things a little bit more intensely, it could potentially be because of how we're judging our feelings, and then it compounds it. If we're maybe kind of feeling a bit muted, it also could be kind of a protective thing. So maybe we can kind of check in on that way, but we are fully equipped with all the emotions that we need to feel.
That we need to, and it's different for everybody.
And it's different for everybody.
Some people are like, kind of like, I have just the right amount of feelings.
That's right, right?
Yeah. What's your hot message?
I think my hot message would be to just stay open. I love that we're having a conversation like this, and that we get to kind of like offer up kind of different perspectives and different therapeutic approaches and opportunities, just to stay open to, you know, things that maybe have been seemed really taboo or less traditional for so long, because there can be really great, very kind of medically backed opportunities for us to maybe kind of process some stuff in really healthy ways. So just kind of stay open to treatment.
Right. Piggybacking on that, staying open. We discuss so much on this show, placing value judgments on our feelings.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I started going to therapy and speaking to a professional that I even knew that I was doing that.
Yeah.
Sadness is bad. Happiness is good. Yes. Anger is bad, because, you know, the behaviors I saw modeled growing up were not really positive, weren't really, really great. So you have to come to your own conclusion about the emotions and consider taking the value judgment off.
Yes,
for a second, if they were just feelings instead of good or bad ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Where can people find you on your socials, big boy? Yeah,
you
who's,
can find
who's
me.
Your big boy? Who's your big boy?
You can find me at...
So dumb.
You can find me at MJ Dempsey Psych on Instagram, Twitter, and Matthew J. Dempsey Psychotherapy on Facebook.
Under follow me at Big Boy MJ Dempsey. Follow me at Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Alec Mappa. Also follow us on Instagram on the Hot Mess Pod. We love hearing from you. I get so many great messages week after week. Don't forget to download and subscribe. We talk about mental health every week. Don't be embarrassed about it. Let's normalize this conversation. Tune in next week. We'll have more Hot Mess fun. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a Stage 29 podcast production. The podcast is executive produced by Patty Ciano, Laferne Cusack, and Stephanie Kaysen. Our audio editors are Jackson Ruff and Jonathan DeMatti. Callie Kiltz is the social media producer. And a special thanks to the rest of our podcast crew, Rwani Horenigay, William Cusack, Lisa Clark, Katie Brown, and Morgan Kaler.
This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.